Hey, it's Latif from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. And here we are, all aboard the New Nation Express, bound for prosperity.
Here was the United States 100 years ago, a new nation of vast distances where opportunity awaited those who had the courage and initiative to seize it.
In the 1850s, a disconnected nation built itself a network of railroads at a huge cost to the environment and the indigenous people living in the West, and created the conditions for an industrial expansion the world had never known.
Suddenly, in the 19th century, you have people coming together in cities and working together in factories and offices, in companies. And the whole character of work is completely transformed. This was the birth of innovation in the world.
Sound familiar? A network of cities tied together by railroad tracks and eventually telephone lines? Well, the power of the railroads to favor one customer over another encouraged the creation of huge business empires in the 1800s, steel, oil, banking, until the courts forced the railroads to be considered common carriers. Basically, they were a platform for all to use, regulated by the government to treat all customers fairly and equally. The common carrier doctrine set the stage for a U.S. economy that we will talk about later this hour with the Nobel Prize-winning economist Edmund Phelps. You just heard him there. But first, the common carrier notion in our time was struck down this week. Despite being extended into the landline phone business in the 20th century, the U.S. courts held yesterday that the FCC has not declared Internet service providers to be common carriers, and so therefore it cannot force them to treat customers equally. The courts essentially declared the Obama administration's principle of net neutrality null and void. The decision sets the stage for a very different Internet experience depending on which provider you use and what other businesses that provider is in partnerships with. Scott Cleland joins us, chairman of Net Competition, an e-forum that represents broadband interests including AT&T and Verizon. Scott, welcome. Susan Crawford joins us, visiting professor at Harvard Law School and author of Captive Audience, The Telecom Industry, and Monopoly Power in the New Gilded Age. Susan, welcome to you.
Hi, John. Thanks to be here.
Let's take the simple issue first. Scott Cleland, should Internet service providers be declared common carriers?
No, they shouldn't, because they basically need the ability to innovate and to adapt and change on a daily basis. What common carrier regulation requires is a mother may I system, where if you want to build fiber, if you want to invent a new service, if you want to do something new and different and innovative, you have to ask a regulator, and a regulator may take months or years to get back to you. And that's the reason why the telephone, if you know, since we had common carrier regulation from 1934 on, the phone didn't change for about 50 years. You had cell phones delayed for 33 years. So under common carrier, where you have to ask the government for permission to innovate, things just don't happen. And that's the reason why for 40 years the FCC policy has been to move away from common carrier regulation towards the Internet and towards unregulated information services space.
Susan Crawford, common carrier in railroad terms doesn't even come close to describing the way the Internet works in our time. Common carrier, what would you say?
Absolutely wrong. It turns out that common carriage was what made the commercial Internet in the United States take off. Had it not been for these regulations limiting the power of the telephone companies to pick winners and losers and decide whether computers could connect to their lines and decide whether to interconnect with other networks, we wouldn't have had an Internet. And in fact, high-speed Internet access was a common carriage service until about 10 years ago, when Michael Powell, then the chairman of the FCC and now the head of the Cable Association, decided that competition in Internet access would protect Americans and that we didn't need regulation. Well, it turns out over the last 10 years, we've seen enormous consolidation in the Internet access market to the point where for high-capacity connections, most Americans have one choice. It's their local cable monopoly. And yesterday's ruling said to the FCC, look, you can't deregulate with one hand, as you did 10 years ago, and then try to impose net neutrality rules With the other hand, this is a fight over labeling. The FCC can go back and simply say, yes, internet access is a common carriage service, and we need it to be in order for innovation to stay alive in the United States to compete in the world stage.
Can we just talk about a legal detail here that basically this ruling comes out of the fact that the FCC wanted to have it both ways. They wanted the regulation of net neutrality, but they didn't want to declare the internet service providers common carriers. If they'd just done that, we'd be having a different conversation, right, Scott Cleland?
Well, we would have a very sad conversation because, you know, as Susan said, for, you know, 10 years ago, we didn't have this. And what happened over the last 10 years? The U.S. developed to have the most competitive broadband system in the entire world by far. We're the only country in the world that has two wireline ubiquitous lines, cable and telephone, into everybody's homes. We have four national providers. And we also wouldn't have had smartphones. You know, now 75% of cell phone users have smartphones. That was all enabled because we didn't have common carrier regulation. So nothing bad happened over the last 10 years, and amazing, innovative advances have happened.
Can I, Scott, I know I'm more of a mediator here, but sure. Can I just push back on that? I mean, yes, people have smartphones, but they're also more dependent on that smartphone platform to have access to the software they want, and they have to use the gatekeepers that are now free to do whatever they want. So people may have more smartphones, but they're also more dependent and are going to get more dependent based on this ruling, right?
No, they aren't, because remember, these are businesses who make their money from allowing people to go freely where they want. And this notion of Susan's that somehow these companies have an economic incentive to not have their customers go where they want, those customers would leave them. It's a competitive marketplace. So the premise here that somehow there's an economic incentive to not be open, to block, it just doesn't make sense.
Susan?
Well, Judge Tatel yesterday on the D.C. Circuit disagreed. He said the commission has shown that absent rules like those in the Open Internet Order, these high-speed internet access providers represent a threat to internet openness. Scott has his facts a bit wrong. There has been investment in the United States. There's also been enormous dividing up of markets to the point where the major cable providers never compete with each other. The wireless guys have completely retreated from installing wires. You know, John D. Rockefeller often said, "You misunderstand me. You misunderstand Standard Oil and its direction. Of course, we have every incentive to serve the market." But what he wasn't saying was that what he wants to do is control and be able to charge more for the same infrastructure. And that's where we are with high-speed internet access today.
Can I put that to you, Scott? I mean, in the worst times of the Standard Oil and the railroad disputes that really created the common carrier doctrine, really what happened was people thought they had free access to the railroads, but because of the way the deals were being made under the table, they actually weren't getting it. And that could be the case here, that people feel like they're going freely from one platform to another. But in fact, without net neutrality, you don't know if you're paying the lowest price, right?
Well, the premise you're approaching this on is incorrect, and I would suggest that Susan has her facts right. We all know we had a monopoly telephone company. We know that back in the 90s that cable was a monopoly. Well, the telephone now, 75% of consumers have chosen a competitive choice rather than the original telephone monopoly. And we know that almost half of people have chosen a competitor to cable, whether it be DirecTV, Dish, or AT&T, or Verizon. Now, your listeners know. They see the ads from these companies every day ad nauseum. They know they have competitive choice, and it's not a monopoly.
So you don't mind if, you know, NBC favors Comcast on your internet provider for content at the expense of other people and other programming that you might want?
Well, for example, what's talked about is, can somebody sponsor somebody else's data? Meaning, when you market or you want to offer something, much like free breakfast with a hotel room or free car financing with buying a car, you could say that, hey, would a content provider want to pay for a consumer's bandwidth? It's basically saying, will somebody pay the bill for download of a consumer's bill? Consumer wins from that. But what the way in Susan's world, if any consumer gets a freebie, there's something wrong. And what I don't understand is why broadband can't be like a newspaper where you have both sides, an advertiser and a subscriber, paying for the huge cost of the infrastructure. You know,
Let's get a comment from Susan there. I mean, with the complexity of people's cable bills, I just wonder how transparent things really are here, Susan.
Yeah, actually, this is a very simple story. Scott is throwing in the idea of pay television as part of the market. I'm talking about high-speed internet access. And in that marketplace, more than 77% of Americans have just one choice, and that's their local cable monopoly. So I was just in Sweden, where you, in Stockholm, you can get five or six choices of fiber to the home provider into your home, 100 megabits per second service, $29 a month. There, I'm paying four times as much in New York City for no choice. I have no choice. So on the biggest frame here, John, the story is that America, when it comes to very high capacity penetration of high-speed internet access, is now 14th among developed nations. We're playing a lot more for this service than most other countries in Asia and Northern Europe. And we have very, very few choices. And now the FCC has been told by the D.C. Circuit, you have no authority to do anything about this.
All right, Scott Cleland, that's the big argument then. So common carrier notion that created the railroad infrastructure created the best industrial infrastructure in the world and paved the way for America's global dominance in the 20th century. Why is this patchwork quilt, net neutrality, out of the picture policy of the FCC not going to constrain the U.S. and keep it from being as good as Sweden or Korea on in terms of internet access?
Of the telephone, the railroad, and what we've seen, as Susan said, over the last 10 years, we haven't had that common carrier under her terms, and what we've seen is the explosion of all the internet and how good all the good innovations that have been delivered by it. So,
but respond to the point. Respond to the point. Why won't we catch up with Sweden?
Well, what she likes to do is what she's doing is comparing apples and oranges, or she's just focusing on part of it. She's very selective in her facts. In the U.S., we have chosen a market-based system where we care about utilization. We don't want to waste our investment, and so we don't build out, you know, super gigabit fast things because somebody is having to pay for the bill. And so what we do is when people have the demand for extra high speed, we build it and we provision it. And so that's the benefit of a private and a marketplace and not a free market and not government. And what the problem with it, when government does it, is there's no innovation and they overbuild. They may be able to say they have a faster service, but most people don't know they don't need all that. In order to, if you had four HDTVs running in your house, you probably need 40 megabits at the most. And people are saying they need a gigabit. So what she's saying is aspirationally, we're behind other governments who have decided to invest too early and wastefully. In a marketplace, that doesn't happen in the U.S.
All right, I give you the first word, Scott. Susan, final thoughts?
America should be leading the world when it comes to reasonably priced internet access. And I'm very concerned that the FCC has not acted to protect the country's ability to move forward. And I'm hopeful that this ruling will prompt them to do so.
Susan Crawford, visiting professor at Harvard Law School, author of Captive Audience, The Telecom Industry, and Monopoly Power in the New Gilded Age, and Scott Cleland, chairman of Net Competition, an e-forum that represents broadband interests, including AT&T and Verizon Internet Service Providers. Scott and Susan, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.